want to take a moment to welcome you. Appreciate your presence this evening. And all of those who are visiting with us, I want you to know that I am encouraged by your presence. I know this congregation is encouraged that you've made a decision to come and be a part of the service tonight. It is my hope and my prayer that the things we do, the things that we say, will be the truth of God. And I encourage you, remind you that you have a responsibility to know that truth and to live by it. I want to take just a moment to express my sincerest gratitude and joy for the opportunity to be here. We love Danny and Karen and his family. Believe that they are servants of God. Believe that Danny is a teacher of God's word, and I have the utmost respect for him and the things that he does as a gospel preacher, as someone who is charged with taking the message to those who are lost, but also building up the saints. And I know that Danny is doing that job. I know he is doing it well. I have heard from many, many here in this congregation the way that they appreciate and love Danny, you and your family, and I understand why. Also want to take just a moment to thank the elders. I know that you had a very major part in me coming. I know that you oversee the work of this congregation, as you should, and I thank you for extending the invitation to me for these few days. I have thoroughly enjoyed it. I've been encouraged. My wife and I both have been encouraged by your kindness, by your hospitality to those who help to take care of our needs as far as food is concerned. We appreciate that. And I said, I believe the very first service or the very first day that several come from time to time to San Antonio. We have grandchildren there drawing about three different families to come and visit with us. But the rest of you, if you are in San Antonio, please come and visit with us at Grissom Road. We would love to have you. We would love for you to come and be a part of our group there. Tonight's lesson, I intend to be kind of a summary of the things I was trying to accomplish. The elders gave me some guidance. They gave me some thoughts, some things that they would like to see from this time together. And I tried to put together those things that I felt like they wanted. I have to tell you, I was thrilled to be able to talk about the things that we have this week. Any Bible topic is important. There are some, as we all have our own little likes and dislikes, there are some, I think, that we naturally get excited about. And the things that we've talked about this week, they are part of that in my life. I enjoy talking about the idea of faithfulness. I enjoy talking about the idea of God and the Bible and those kinds of things that we've addressed. And so, in summation tonight, we're going to look at some thoughts, some advice, some lessons from a very wise man. I'm sure that you know a little bit about Solomon, maybe a great deal about Solomon. He was, of course, the son of David. He is the one who succeeded David as king of Judah, the United Kingdom, the kingdom of Israel. It was his son who was reigning, Rehoboam, when the kingdom was torn asunder, when the kingdom was divided between the northern and the southern kingdoms. To a great extent, that came about because of Solomon's sin, because of Solomon's rebellion. He was a young man when he became king, and the Lord asked him, "What would you like?" He gave him, if you will, a wish. And there were no conditions on that wish. And Solomon did, in fact, show a great deal of wisdom in his request, because he knew his age, his youthfulness, and he understood that he would need some judgment, that he would need some understanding. And so he asked of God that God would give him that judgment to be able to rule the people. And there's no doubt that he had a tremendous wisdom about him. But we also know about Solomon that he made some terrible mistakes. And probably the greatest mistake that he made was the women he chose to marry. And you know the numbers, don't you? 700 wives, 300 concubines. And we stand back and how in the world could that even be? And then we read about who these women were, and we read about what he did for them, because many of them were from other nations. Him trying to find some way of having an alliance with other nations. He would marry the daughters of those kings. And while Solomon did, in fact, build the temple of God, and he had a building project, if you will, as we'll talk about in a few moments, he also built temples to the gods of his wives. And so Solomon, in all of his wisdom, made some horrible mistakes. And most believe, and I'm one of those, that in the book of Ecclesiastes, we have kind of a time period when Solomon is now toward the end of his life. He's looking back, he is reflecting, and he's giving the advice based upon the choices and the decisions that he made. And the entirety of the book really has to do with someone who is trying to find fulfillment, the meaning of life, in the worldly things that we find. And so we often ask the question, do we not? Why am I here? And what should I be doing? We also ask the question, what do I really get out of my effort? If I'm going to do this, if I'm going to apply myself, what am I getting out of that? In the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 1, in verse 2 beginning, "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher, "vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes, and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever." And so, in the very beginning of this book, he really defines for us his mindset. And he really answers the question that when you look at this life, everything is vain, everything is empty. The things of this life simply do not give us a lot of hope and encouragement and peace and comfort. And as you go about looking for these things in this life, you're going to be disappointed. And he tells us that really things remain the same, do they not? Vanity of vanities. All is vanities. The word vanity there, according to Strong, is the Hebrew habel. The primary meaning, vapor or breath, emptiness, figuratively something transitory and unsatisfactory. Barnes says of the word, denotes what passes away more or less quickly and completely, leaves either no result or no adequate result behind, and therefore fails to satisfy the mind of man, which naturally craves for something permanent and progressive. By the way, that word, habel, is the word we read in the book of Genesis, chapter 4, the second son of Adam and Eve, Abel. Abel. And is that not a suitable name? Abel's life was snuffed out early. A man of God, a man of faith. And when you look on his life, there's very little that you really see about him, except he was a man of faith. And so, whatever we are facing, whatever we are thinking, whatever we are feeling or doing, we need to understand something. Life is no different today than what it was years and years and years ago. The truth is, whatever you are experiencing in your time of life, chances are people have experienced before you. In fact, I'll say this. I want to say this to our young people, to our teenagers, who maybe feel like mom and dad don't understand. I want you to understand something. They went through exactly the same emotions and feelings and temptations that you go through. I know it's hard to believe that. I know as you look at your parents, you see two people and you envision them as being above all of this. You can't imagine them going through these things. And yet, they did. They understand very well what you are going through. In the book of Ecclesiastes 1, in verse 8, as we continue on, all things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. There is a thing of which it is said, see, this is new. It has already been done in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of latter things yet to be among those who come after. And again, the idea is we live in our own little time and space. And we think, well, whatever was done in the past, things are different today. And we're certainly not able to see into the future. Solomon said, no. No. Everything is the same. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. I realize that we have different devices and tools. I understand that we have air conditioner. They did not, of course, in Solomon's day, at least not like we have it. I understand that we have automobiles they did not have. But when you look at the essence of life, none of that matters. Those are not the things that really define life and that make life what it is. Those are not the things that answer the question, why am I here and what should I be doing? Or what do I really get out of all of my effort? What we find is Solomon trying to answer these questions of life. And so in the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 1 and verse 13, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business. Listen to that. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. An unhappy business. Sore travail, a grievous occupation, burdensome task, sad. That's the idea here. Solomon's saying it is sad. It is a sore travail to think of what we have to do in this life. It's not easy. The idea of being busy here includes the idea of affliction. It's hard. We are wearied by it. Do you ever feel tired with all that is going on? Do you ever have those moments when you feel like you're drained and you cannot possibly do one more thing, no matter what it is? And you're exhausted with life. You're exhausted with what you have to do. That's what Solomon is saying. That's life. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight. He says, I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge, and I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is but a striving after wind. In much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. In this context here, he's talking about the fact that trying to learn from the natural elements of this world, it's flawed. And we cannot really change anything about living. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be counted. There's not much we can do about things. And it's sheer arrogance to think that we can educate ourselves and learn enough that we can find the answer. He talks about this discernment between wisdom and madness and folly. And then he says, and isn't this true? Earthly wisdom and knowledge, it can actually raise up more problems, more than what it answers. And we see that all the time, don't we? Because you see, there is a limit. We're not able to get that knowledge of everything. And so, why am I here? What should I be doing? Well, Solomon said, I'm going to look in pleasure. And so in chapter 2 and verse 1, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad and a pleasure. What use is it? And then in the next few verses, he describes the manner in which he sought after this in pleasure. He talks about wine. Yes, and I believe that in the context, it has to be intoxicating wine. He talks about all of the great works that he did. He talks about building houses. I mentioned that a few moments ago. He talks about planting vineyards and gardens and parks and fruit trees. He talks about pools that he uses to water those parks and fruit trees. He talks about the slaves, male and female, that he has. He talks about the herds and the flocks, the silver and the gold. He talks about the singers that come in and entertain him when he's down. He had everything. There was nothing that he could not go out and buy. He was that rich. And in verse 10, he says, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil that I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and the striving after the wind. There was nothing to be gained under the sun. And so he says, all of this that I did, none of it answered the questions. None of it gave me the reason I am here and what I can do to get the most out of life. I've never been in the position where I could go out and just buy whatever my heart's desire is. There are people in the world who can pretty much do that with the material things. Solomon was one of those men. He also talks about the idea that even though he indulged himself in every pleasure, all of this was fleeting. There was no long-term value. It was still empty. It was still vain. And then he talks about the concept that it's better to be wise than foolish, but just barely. In chapter 2 and verse 12, so I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is no more gain in wisdom than folly, and there is no more gain in light than in darkness. And so as you go through this, what he finds out is that basically the same things happen to everyone. You may be wise, you may be foolish. The same things happen to everyone. He talks about the idea that the wise and foolish, they are both forgotten. They both die in the same manner. He talks about the fact that in all of his work, all of his accomplishments, that when all is said and done, they're going to go to someone else. Someone else who may be foolish, in fact. Reborn. And yes, there may be a societal advantage to being wise over being foolish, but it's not the answer. It is still empty. It is still vanity. And so in chapter 3, there is a season and time for every matter. In verse 1, for everything there's a season and a time for every matter under heaven. And then he goes on and talks about these things. Time to be born, a time to die, and so on. And he wants us to understand something. He wants us to understand that everything is really beautiful in its time. In verse 11, he has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceived that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. If you're talking about something that is purely earthly in nature, purely physical in nature, This is what you can get out of it. But he also warns in verse 17 that God is going to judge. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. The truth is, not only do the wise and foolish die in the same way, now he actually says that man and beast die in the same way. In verse 19, for what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beast is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beast, for all is vanity. He's not speaking here to man's soul. We understand that there is a difference between the being of a human being, and those of an animal. What he's talking about here is the breath of life as it pertains to this world. There's no advantage, he says. From a worldly perspective, the best we can get out of life is to rejoice in the moment. That's all that we get from this life. You want a good night's sleep? In chapter 5 and verse 10, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. Now please understand the point here. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. In other words, you're going to have a lot of friends if you get to that point of wealth. If you can buy things for someone, if you can provide things for someone, then you're not going to have a shortage of friends. They're going to be there with you to help you eat them, to help you enjoy them. And so really what advantage is there to the owner? Because you see all of these friends, they're right there with it. Well, the advantage is, and again, it's empty, but to see them with his eyes. And then he talks about the one who is a laborer, the one who works hard, the one who maybe even barely gets by. Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much. But the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. There's always something to keep him up. You want to avoid worry? Verse 15. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Moreover, all his days he eats darkness and much vexation and sickness and anger. In other words, as you strive for all of these things, as you try to gain more and more and more what this world has to offer, understand you cannot take any of it with you. You know, the Pharaohs, they used to try to take it with them. And they had their goods, and sometimes even their servants alive, buried with them. But you see, the truth is, none of that goes where we're going. The truth is, none of that can transcend this world. It's all here, and that's all. And in fact, he says, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. You see, these are not the things that are going to help you to avoid worry. These are the things that are going to add to it. In chapter 6, in verse 1 and verse 2, there is an evil that I have seen under the sun. It lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him, listen to this, power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity. It is a grievous evil again. And again, it has to do with the idea that you work hard and you die, you can't take it with you. Someone else gets it. And so you're not even really able to enjoy the material things that God has given you or that God has provided by his creation. In chapter 7, in verse 1, a good name is better than precious ointment. The day of death than the day of birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting. For this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It is better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the songs of the fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is laughter of the fools. This also is vanity, he says. And so we have here a comparison of things. And it doesn't make sense to us if we are materially minded, if we are looking to this world, if we're looking to what God has given us by creation. We would not think it is better to have a good name or the day of birth. A good name, the day of death. Is better than the day of birth. It's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. The house of mourning is probably talking about a situation where maybe someone has died or there's been some tragedy, some harm, and you're there and you are sorrowful, and it may even be an uncontrolled sorrow. I'm reminded of David when the first child died, he and Bathsheba had because of his sin. I'm reminded of how David wept and how David fasted, how David prayed for those days that the child was alive. When the child died, he moved on. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of the face the heart is made glad. These are all things that Solomon came to understand. These were the things he looked for, but yet he did not find joy and happiness in them. And so he came to realize a good name really is better. The day of birth really is better than the day of the day of death really is better than the day of birth. In chapter 8 and verse 2, a respect for authority. I say keep the king's command because of God's oath to him. Be not hasty to go from his presence. Do not take your stand in an evil cause, for he does whatever he pleases. So here he says you need to respect the king. You need to keep his commandment. You need to understand he has absolute authority. You need to realize that you cannot challenge him. For the word of the king is supreme, and who may say to him, what are you doing? If you want to have the goodwill and the protection of the king, then you respect him. You keep his commandments. If you don't do that, he says, trouble lies heavy on that person. In chapter 8, in verse 12, life is not always fair, he comes to realize. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and prolongs his life, yet I know that it will be well with those who fear God because they fear before him. So when you compare again the earthly things, the evil, the sinner, doing all of this contrary to God's will, he just prolongs his life and everything seems to be going well. Solomon says, I know that it will be well with those who fear God because they fear before him. But it will not be well with the wicked. Neither will he prolong his days like a shadow because he does not fear before God. There is a vanity that takes place on earth. Now listen, that there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked. Does that seem fair? And there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. And so when you look at these people, you see, well, this guy, he's a good guy, and he's trying to serve God, but things are going poorly for him from an earthly standpoint. And here you have someone who's wicked, who doesn't believe in God, who blasphemes God, who does anything and everything that he wants to do. And he's the one who's blessed. I said that this also is vanity. You know, a lot of claims are made out there by people who believe that they have the answers, who believe that they can, in fact, find their happiness in this life and in this world. In Ecclesiastes 8, in verse 17, "Then I saw all the work of God, that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. However much man may toil in seeking, he will not find it. Even though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find it." When I think of a wise man claiming to know, there are different pictures that comes to mind, because we're talking about people who are trying to figure out really what is in the realm of God. Man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. In other words, in the world in which we live, in this natural universe, I think he's saying. However much a man toils in seeking, he will not find it. And yet we listen to people today, and we talked about this in our lesson on origin. There are people who think that they have it all figured out by the way of organic evolution, and they think that they have all of the answers there and that they can prove these things, and they cannot. And so please understand that you should not follow the words of someone who thinks he's wise, claims to be wise, claims to know, when that word contradicts the Bible. Let me tell you, we begin with the Bible, we end with the Bible. Let me tell you that when some man, and I don't care what kind of background or degree that he has, pedigree that he has, when someone says something that is blatantly contrary to God's word, we take the word of God. If we don't, then the word of God has no authority for us. Claims don't make it so. But I also want you to understand something else, he says. If you are alive, there's hope. And so he's going through all of this, again, as the wise man, as the preacher. And he is reflecting, and now he is revealing what he has come to believe, what he's come to understand. But he wants us to realize something. As long as we are alive, there is hope. I don't know what happened in the final days of Solomon. I don't know what God's judgment will be concerning his life. That is God's business, not mine. But what I do know, and what I think he has gotten right here, as long as we are alive, as long as we have our senses about us, as long as we are honest and sincere, we can turn back to God. In verse 4 of chapter 9, "He who is joined with all the living has hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion." We need to do the very best we can do. That's what Solomon came to realize in chapter 9 and verse 10. "Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol to which you are going. Again, I saw under the sun, the race is not to the swift, nor to the battle, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge, but time and chance happen to them all." What's he saying here? He's saying you do your best. That does not always guarantee success, but you do your best. And in doing your best, you understand that there are things out there out of your control. There are things out there that you cannot overcome, that you cannot determine. But do your best and realize your need for God. Make the very best use of the time that you have here upon this earth. Solomon had wasted much of that time as king. In Ecclesiastes chapter 11 and verse 8, "So if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all. But let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. All that comes is vanity. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth. And let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes." It sounds to me like Solomon is telling the youth, our young people, you're in a pretty good time in your life. You are at a time in your life when you have vigor and vitality and you have strength. And as you continue to progress, that begins to leave little by little by little. And so when you are young, realize that there's going to be that day, if you live long enough, where darkness will come. And he says you need to rejoice in your youth. You need to be cheerful in your heart. You need to walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes. But there's a caveat to that. But know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. And so, yes, young person, go out there and live a good life. But make sure that that good life is in harmony with God's will. As a 15-year-old, 16-year-old, as a 20-year-old, as a 25-year-old, you can have a great life, a joyful life, a fulfilled life, and please God. You don't have to follow the crowd. You don't have to do what everyone else is doing. And that's the whole purpose, I think, of this writing. Solomon had tried it all. He'd done it all. And what he's saying is, it's all vanity. And so, young person, whatever that is, you understand that you're going to be held accountable. A couple of things to think about. Tragedy hits young people. Young people sometimes lose their lives. And we think to ourselves, that's not fair. And we think to ourselves, he or she did not have a chance to live a full life. And that's right. If a young person is at the age of accountability, if a young person is making choices that take him or her further away from God, and they do not repent, they do not come back, they do not obey the gospel in baptism, if a young person is outside of Christ as a sinner, that young person is going to face an eternity away from God and in the torment that he has prepared. There's another thought as well. You do these things as a young person. You develop habits. You come to like the things that you're doing. And then as you grow a little bit older, you begin to think and to reason, but you still like what you're doing. And you find out, even when you reach a point and you want to make some changes, it's hard to make those changes because you've developed habits. You become accustomed to doing this. You like doing this. And so realize, young person, that if you allow yourself to do as Solomon did and to just go out and try to find the meaning of life by all of the evils that this world can offer, it's going to be that much more difficult for you to turn your life and to serve God. And then finally, the conclusion of the whole matter. In chapter 12, verse 11, the words of the wise are like goads and like nails, firmly fixed, are the collected sayings. They are given by one shepherd. My son, beware of anything beyond these. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. He is not in any way disparaging the idea of learning. But what he's telling you is that when you learn all of these things, you learn about history, you learn about math, you learn about technology, you learn about science, all fine and good for the present and now. But those are not the things that are going to make your life meaningful and fulfilled. In fact, you do all of that, and you do more of that, and you do more of that, and what do you have? You have a hunger yet for more, and you're not satisfied. There are people who will spend their entire lives immersed in this kind of education, this kind of learning, and there's nothing wrong with knowledge. The end of the matter, all has been heard. In other words, we've weighed all of this. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. You see, why am I here? And what should I be doing? Is answered by Solomon. Is it worth our while? Well, it depends on what you spend your life doing. It's not worth your while to put all of your interests in this world and thinking that this world is going to satisfy your greatest needs. It's not. It's not going to give you that peace of mind. It's not going to give you that comfort. On the other hand, if you dedicate your life to serving God, if you put your interest there, your energies there, then that service, that faithfulness, that union with God that comes from obeying Him, then that is going to give you the meaning of life that counts. Why? Because God is going to bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. I hope and pray that as we go through life, we remember the lessons that Solomon learned the hard way. You know, you think about Solomon, you think, well, there's a lot to want to emulate there. You know, we might think to ourselves, I'd kind of like to be like Solomon. And that's true in some ways. But boy, he made a lot of mistakes. He made a lot of mistakes. Made his life difficult. The mistakes that he made then came down and followed through with his son Rehoboam, the divided kingdom. Solomon tells the truth here, that the answer is not out in this world. The answer is not in your job. The answer is not in education. The answer is not even in your family, your earthly family, your physical family. The answer is in serving God. And so I hope and pray that you will make that commitment, that you will be absolutely dedicated to your service to God, and that you apply yourself in that end. Again, and Solomon makes this point, the things of this world are to be enjoyed. The things of this world have been given to us by God. Keep them where they belong. If you're not a Christian, then tonight I would implore you to come forward, confess your faith in Jesus Christ, and be baptized. If you are a child of God, you've sinned against Him, then come back. Learn the lessons that Solomon learned the hard way. Respond if you need to us. Together we stand and we sing the song of encouragement.